The Athletic Podcast Network is supported by the Quip electric toothbrush, known as the iPhone of toothbrushes. Engineered by industrial designers, Quip is sleek and simple. Time magazine named Quip one of their best inventions of the year. GQ declared it one of the best grooming products on the market, and Oprah put it on her prestigious O list. Join millions of brushers who use Quip to make their mouths happy and healthy. Get your first refill free at getquip.com/listen. That's getquip.com/listen.
They looking at y'all. Y'all can easily, like, brainwash people with y'all bullshit. And it's not about you. Yeah. If you're a media guy, nobody cares about you.
Bring out your dad! Bring out your dad!
Welcome to the House of Strauss on the Athletic Podcast Network.
So are the animal rights activists mad about the geese, or can you get the feathers off the geese without killing them? Does anybody know?
Every animal activist hates Canada Goose. In fact, you can buy a Canada Goose jacket without the logo. So people who are PETA people don't throw red blood on you. Did you know that?
Oh, so I didn't know that. So they're mad about it.
Geese are a menace. Absolute menace, particularly to airplanes.
They're mean. They're very mean.
They're like the camels with wings.
I like that analog. I like that analog a lot. They bite.
Thank you.
They run at you. There's a ton of them in Oakland on Lake Merritt. Is a swan a goose with better branding?
Oh, God.
I need to look into this difference between goose and swan. I'll figure that one out later. I mean, the swans, nobody's talking about swan feathers. Anyway, I guess we're going right now. Vinny, how do you sound?
How do I sound?
You sound good. It's not quite so distorted. It's not quite so
one small step for man, one large step for mankind,
or whatever was said. It's not that audio quality, but it's pretty good.
Whatever works, because I'm sure that Ethan is going to take me down some godforsaken road.
We're going to talk. I think we might talk a lot about you. I don't know where I want to take this, but you got to be prepared for that.
I hate talking about me.
Yeah, you just got to accept it.
I hate that.
Doesn't sound like he's talking from the inside of a triple fat goose jacket.
Bring out your dead!
Here's one.
Ninepence.
I'm not dead.
What?
Nothing. Here's your ninepence.
I'm not dead. Here. He says he's not dead.
Yes, he is.
I'm not. He isn't?
Well, he will be soon. He's very ill.
I'm getting better.
No, you're not. You'll be stone dead in a moment. Isn't there something you can do?
I feel happy. I feel happy.
Oh, thanks very much.
Talk to
you on Thursday.
I'm going to put a bow on it.
Yeah, you can't run from it. At the same time, I am laughing my ass off that the other media members are out there in freezing weather with the wind. Once the wind is near 20. Woo. Anyway, welcome to the House of Strauss podcast. We are joined by Vinny Goodwill of Yahoo. And I have to say, I was stumbling over your name, man. I was stumbling over your name because I am recording my audiobook. And you are appropriately credited for creating the death lineup moniker.
Bring out your dead.
I don't know if everybody knows that, too. I don't know if everybody gives you your proper credit. And it's mentioned in the book, and I kept tripping over it because I have to use your official name. I have to say Vincent Goodwill. And in my head, it's Vinny. I think it's especially Vinny, too, because that's what Stan Van Gundy would always say. He'd say Vinny. Vinny thinks he runs the team. Back when you were a beat reporter for the Detroit Pistons. So I just kept seeing the line and going as coined by I couldn't do it, man. It was difficult. Vincent?
You know what? Here's the difference. And you know this, Ethan Sherwood Strauss. Like, there's a difference between someone who says your full name and someone who says your informal name. that indicates that they know you. If you call me Vinny, I know that you know me. Like, I don't know if you're one of these people that maybe sometimes strangers approach you in public and you're like, okay, let me place who you are to me. If you say Vincent, I know you have no idea who the hell I am. You only know me from my byline. If you say Vince, there may be some level of familiarity there, but normally it's probably through my work. If you say Vinny, then you know me. Even if you know me through my work, there is a level of connectivity and intimacy there, because only people who have known me since I was five or people that I really, really, really like call me Vinny.
So you're like Irvin Magic Johnson with the three names, where the people who really knew him would call him Buck. And then the people who knew him informally would call him Magic. And then there's this other tier of person who would call him Irvin. You've got the three. That's pretty good.
Well, I feel like Irvin Magic Johnson is like three different people. I feel like Magic is what you show the world. And I feel like Irvin is basically who Magic really is behind closed doors. Mm. One of those type of things. I'm not that dude.
I mean, I get that. I like that you've got a different system, though. But speaking of names, I mean, how do you feel about that? I was thinking about it when I was reading it. How do you feel about creating the Death Lineup name? This is something that's on t-shirts, by the way, out here. And not seeing a damn nickel from it, seeing nothing from it. How do you feel about that?
You know what's funny? I never thought about it. Not until Bomani had said something to me about it once. Bomani Jones from ESPN, a good friend of both of ours. When I created the moniker, it wasn't like I was trying to like create something. It was literally, and you were there at the game. The Bulls were in Oakland, and they just put on this amazing second quarter run in like maybe a November 15th game or something. Somewhere in the middle of November, the Bulls went out west and all this other stuff. And they just put on this amazing second quarter run. And that's when the Warriors were starting off, what, 24-0 or whatever it was. And you look at the lineup and you're like, man, this lineup just kills you. It's like the lineup of death. It's a death lineup. And I'm just saying it. It's not something I'm writing down on paper or anything like that. To be perfectly honest, I forgot it as quick as I said it. Like, once I left, I didn't think, oh, I just created something. I didn't even remember I said it until someone said, yeah, you created death lineup. I was like, really? I did? Like, it was literally that type of thing. So if I remembered it, Ethan, I could say, man, I should have trademarked it and all that type of stuff and, you know, did the Pat Riley thing. But because I didn't, I'm not tripping on it. And to be honest, it's kind of cool to see something I think Jeff Van Gundy said, it's the most overused term in sports. And I was like, that's pretty cool that Jeff Van Gundy is saying it's the most overused term in sports when nobody knew what the hell it was like 5 months earlier.
Well, I think Nate Duncan noticed that it came from you. Otherwise, your credit might have been lost to history. Somebody else might have gotten credit for it. People keep trying to give me credit for it. You talk about people walking down the street and calling you Vincent. I'm just walking down the street and people are thanking me for Death Lineup, even though I had nothing to do with it. And
really?
Look, I think those who don't know are often trying to figure out where it came from. And, you know, it was something where it was really instinctive in a way, and it just conjured it correctly. It was death. They bring death, Death Lineup. It was simple. It was catchy. And that is how things spread a lot of the times. So you give a name to an emergent phenomenon, and it lets the public conceptualize it, and it helps us think about it. And so I think it is cool. It's too bad you couldn't make any money off it, but it's not as bad as Brian Witt, who is working for the Warriors in-house media and came up with Splash Brothers, and it's just on every other piece of merchandise out here.
Oh, yeah.
And he never got it. I think he might have gotten a little bonus, like, good job, buddy. You know, like maybe.
Right.
Yeah, but not. You come up with that. You come up with that. I feel like you should be getting more money off it than Brian Witt got.
Especially with those Bay Area prices. Like, I'd be fighting for every last cent if I lived out there. Don't get me wrong. If I created Death Lineup and I lived in Bay Area where the prices for real estate is death, I would definitely be out there trying to make every last coin out of it. But here's the thing about it, Ethan, was that everything about that team at that moment felt so organic. It felt completely unexpected. Usually, you know, in the course of modern NBA history, you see teams coming whether they're put together or whether they have this amazing role that puts them on the doorstep. You see them coming, so you can prepare for it. You could prepare for the Bulls. You could prepare for the Pistons. You could even to some degree prepare for the San Antonio Spurs once they won that one championship. But with the Warriors, they were not this marquee franchise. They were a franchise that you got to think when 2015 happened, some people were saying that that was going to be a fluke, that that was going to be a one and done type of thing, that teams were going to figure them out. It was very much like a Phoenix Suns-ish type of rhetoric, except they won. So yeah, you couldn't completely, you know, put them in this pantheon of champions. So when they came out the next year and had that amazing winning streak, it was like, we're going to kill all of you guys. We're going to put you to bed. We're going to, you know, put you to death, basically. And I felt like that lineup, when deployed and nobody had an answer for it, you know, when used in doses and everything else, it just felt like the perfect nickname as time went on. It didn't feel like a perfect nickname at the time, but it seemed like they lived up to that nickname, you know, through the rest of that season. And almost that death lineup basically killed them in the finals against the Cavs when they had to use it too much.
Well, yeah, I think Harrison Barnes clanking a lot of open shots had a lot to do with that. And you know, there's a lot that went into it. I think if the Warriors had a vulnerability, it was probably Steph's durability. I think that was the main aspect of it. For all people question the finals track record or the playoff track record, and those questions are fair to ask, small sample size or otherwise. I think if you're really trying to tell the story of why a guy like LeBron James is better than Steph, a lot of it's just that he's not getting hurt in the way that Steph would wear down in some of these postseasons. And that certainly happened in that postseason. And that I do think is part of the overall how you value a player, even if we always act like injuries or something off to the side.
No, you have to consider injuries. I think especially when the air is thin at the top of the top, and it's so hard for people, for traditionalists, to contextualize Stephen Curry, not necessarily in this time, but also through history. Like, Steph's battling not Damian Lillard, not Kyrie Irving, not anybody else. He's battling Magic, Isaiah, Oscar, LeBron. And even though he and LeBron are in the same time, they're not so much battling each other on the floor, even though they've been in the finals every year, you know, since 2015, basically. They're battling each other for a place in history. So you have to pick at the smallest things. LeBron is so durable, right? Even if he wears down, he's still available. Steph, if there's a weakness, let's beat up on him. Let's, even though he's bigger and stronger than you think from a TV screen, he's still 6'3". He still has a little bit of, I'm gonna say frailness, fragility, but like, because that's completely unfair. He's just not RoboCop. Like, LeBron is RoboCop. LeBron is Iron Man. Steph is not that. Steph is more Batman than Superman, if that makes sense. He's more gadgets and all of that.
Players, I think, respect physical dominance even more than fans do because they feel it out there. And there's this sense, because players have a lot of belief in themselves, that if Steph is out there and he faked you one way, then you think to yourself, okay, I'm not going to fall for that next time. But if you're going up against, I don't know, KD, and he just does the turnaround on you, and you can't block it, it's, well, can't do anything about that. And ultimately, they respect that a lot more than something where maybe if they made the right decision, they could have prevented it from happening.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where players respect, they don't have as much respect for the tricks of it, for the vulnerability, for the smarts in the moment. Like, when they look at it on the screen, even if it's not happening to them, if it's happening to someone else, it's the thought, man, stay on your feet. Why are you going for that fake? I could have done that, right? A lot of things that Joe Fan says about Steph. But when, whether it's LeBron or whether it's KD, and it's just this massive human being, God-given, everything is just, you know, chiseled 7-foot anomalies or whatever, you're like, you know what? I just tip my hat to you. There's nothing I can do about that. But here, I will venture to you.
And it's not true, but they feel like it's true. they'll get faked the next time in many instances.
No, they have to rationalize it, Ethan. Because here's the thing. LeBron being 6'9", blessed in that way, like, you players will always say, man, if I was blessed like that, if I had those gifts, I'd be the exact same player or better. Same thing with Kevin Durant. Stephen Curry makes you look at yourself and say, why am I not better? And then you're like, well, he does this tricky stuff and he's not a real superstar and everything else. If I did those tricks, I'd be the same way. I play a man's game. I don't play that trick stuff. And then you're like, wait a minute. That ain't exactly what this is at all. And even though you're bigger and stronger than Stephen Curry, or at least physically comparable, he's better than you. Guys don't like to admit when someone is genuinely better than them. Have you ever come across a player, even if let's say he's a second or third tier player, and you said to them, like I heard Antoine Walker on TV this morning, like as an aside, say, if Dwight Howard's a Hall of Famer, I'm a Hall of Famer. I don't know in what world we live in where Dwight Howard isn't a Hall of Famer, or what world we live in that the equivalency of Dwight Howard and Antoine Walker being in the same class, in the same room, in the same anything as far as greatness of NBA players. But these guys believe that the margins are truly thin and that this tricky hippity-hoppity stuff wouldn't work if you had to see them every night, except it does work every night.
Well, I think there can be a genius in accepting your limitations and being, as Doc Rivers calls it, a superstar in your role. I don't want to get aggregated, which of course means I'm going to get aggregated. And, you know, maybe I'm hearing the second or third hand. I don't know. But a few years ago, Russell Westbrook and Draymond were talking trash to each other and they were yelling at each other. And Russell said, was yelling, you're a terrible, you're a role player. You're a role player. Don't talk to me. You're a role player. You're a role player. And Draymond said something like, you know what? I am a role player. I'm a great role player. You're a terrible superstar.
Oh my God. That's good. I've never heard that, but wow. That is like, isn't that like the epitome of shade? Like, I'm the best at what I do. And even though you're great, you're not really great at what you do. What? How much of a backhanded compliment is that? Yes, I'm acknowledging your superstardom, but you're bad at it.
You're missing every shot.
You're missing every shot. Nobody likes playing with you. Kevin Durant begged to get away from you. Can you imagine all the ammo that Draymond Green had in that very moment to say whatever it was that he sent to Russell Westbrook?
I think it was an effective comeback. But to know those limitations, then you can start excelling at what you excel at. And not everybody can do that. Not everybody is wired that way. I do want to get back to, because I did mention Stan Van Gundy before. I was thinking about that too. I was thinking about, I have a theory. I have a theory that you were harder on Stan Van Gundy when you were a beat writer covering the Detroit Pistons, because you were trying to compensate for how it felt as though all of the media was kissing his ass. Was there any aspect of that? Was there any aspect of that? Because I felt
I never thought about that in that way, Ethan. My thing was, in covering basketball, basically, is the coach can always run and say, well, the general manager didn't do this. The team president didn't do this. The president can always say, the coach didn't do this. He didn't do that, right? I got them all in one in my face all the time. Do you know the levels of accountability that I, as a media person, can impress upon you? But and here's the crazy thing. Me and Stan have a great relationship. Yeah. He complained about me then, and I left midseason to go cover another bad organization in the Chicago Bulls going through their own turmoil. But through the years, me and Stan have had a really, really good relationship, even about the stuff that I blasted him for. I think he expected to be given more rope early. But when you start off 5-23 and you got Josh Smith jacking up 20-footers, I don't see how anybody can defend that.
Well, I think the way is this. It's that Stan is very likable. He's very candid. He is smart. And he did a great job in Orlando. And so a lot of people in media, let's face it, at some level, though they might never admit it, they were rooting for him. They wanted him to do well, even though he probably bit off a bit more than he could chew by having all of those roles at once. And so I think it did create a dynamic where we were giving him a lot of time. That's the way I would put it. And I didn't look at it as, I don't think you were being unfair at all. In fact, I really enjoyed that coverage at the time, and I was disappointed, even though it was probably a good move for you. I just felt like you were holding him accountable and you were assessing the situation as though it was anybody who'd been given that role, as opposed to Stan Van Gundy and the cachet he had at the time.
The crazy thing is, Ethan, people felt like I treated the previous Piston president, Joe Dumars, with kid gloves. And they felt like I was harder on the coaches. And my thought was basically the perspective of where a team is and where they're acting like they should be. Like, if you're acting like you should be better than you are, then I'm going to hold you to a level of accountability that you're asking for. If you're being realistic, like, look, we're not very good. We don't have the players. We're in a certain spot right now with our rebuild, with our franchise. Then I can't beat a dead horse. Like, you've done it yourself. You know, that horse ain't going to go any faster, you know, than it already is, because it's an honest assessment of where this team is. With Stan, he came in saying, we expect to win now, and I can build around this player and that player. And I'm like, okay, cool, fine. I don't agree with that. And I'll tell you, I don't agree with that from the jump. So we'll see who's wrong. Not in a way that I want it to be right, but also in a sense that I was holding myself accountable, because if they started off 23-5 instead of 5-23, I was going to have to eat a whole bunch of crow publicly in the paper, on TV, all this other type of stuff. And I would have been willing to do that. But when you start off that way and you're saying we have enough to win, you can't change the narrative now just to control the conversation. And that's the one thing I felt Stan was really, really good at, because he was a friend of the media. He could turn the conversation from whatever it was to whatever he wanted to be without really explaining the transition. And my thing was creating that gap in the middle, and at least explaining the gap in the middle while understanding he's in a tough spot too. And my thing also was this: don't take the Pistons job when you can take the Golden State job. And you see what that team was doing in the start of the 14-15 season. Now, granted, I don't think that they would have started off or had the same run with Stan Van Gundy as a coach over Steve Kerr. But you can't tell me that that guy didn't have second thoughts looking at that position and saying, man, that is a well-oiled machine. I should be over there. But no, I want all the power. I don't want to just coach. I want to do everything. Like, to me, and he was kind of upset with me with that line of questioning that day. But, you know, he wasn't the first coach to get pissed at me or the last.
A Warren Legarryism I'd like to use is that people, they always correct. And the Warriors might have been overcorrecting with the Mark Jackson hire and how that went by going with a detail-oriented hard ass like Stan Van Gundy as the coach they were pursuing. And Stan Van Gundy might have not taken the Warriors job because he was overcorrecting in response to what happened in Orlando when not having all of the power left him vulnerable to what Dwight Howard did when he was trying to get him out of there. So maybe those factors combined to have Stan not coach the Warriors. But
I agree with that. I think, yeah. I mean, Ethan, you're married, so you don't get this, but usually when you're in a relationship and you break up with someone, what usually happens is you isolate the one thing that you hated about your partner and you make that the exact opposite thing that you're highlighting about your next partner. Yeah. If you have someone who nags and that's the thing that drove you away, then you're not even going to look at the next person's great qualities as much as you're going to look at this.
You're going to go too far.
Don't nag me.
You're going to go with somebody who just barely cares about you.
It's an emotional overcorrection.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, they're not nagging me, but they're not that into me. And they're cheating on me.
You're missing a few other, you know, very, very critical elements that make a relationship work. I mean, put it like this. I covered a Detroit Pistons franchise that changes coaches every 18 months. That is Kardashian-esque. All right. Do you know how bad that is to get used to one coach and then 18 months later, he's gone? Like, and not just, or 55 games later.
Okay,
he's gone.
Can you, as an exercise, name every coach they've had since Larry Brown as fast as you can? Yeah, in order. Yeah.
Flip Saunders, Michael Curry, John Kuster, Maurice Cheeks, John Lawyer. Let me start over. All right. From Flip Saunders, there was Michael Curry. From Michael Curry, there was John Kuster. From John Kuster, there was Lawrence Frank. From Lawrence Frank, there was Maurice Cheeks. From Maurice Cheeks, who was fired midway through the season, there was John Lawyer. Then there was Stan Van Gundy. Now there is my guy, Dwayne Casey.
And for the Spurs, Greg Popovich.
one, right? Just yeah. one.
Yeah. I mean, that's quite the revolving door over there. So you alluded to it a little bit, but you are kind of the minister of losing. You're the king of defeat. It seems as though any situation you've ever been around in this business, the team loses a lot. Did you learn anything about losing? I mean, do you have any grand lessons for us from your time watching just pitiful losers?
Besides being Basketball Kardashian, which is a nickname that I gave myself, wherever I turn up, teams go from sugar to shit, right? Like the Pistons went to 6 straight Eastern Conference Finals. They were a model organization. I show up and all of a sudden they haven't won a playoff series in 11 years, right? The Bulls were a bastion of drama even before I got there, right? But Derrick Rose was an MVP guy, and he, even though he had gotten hurt and everything else, but there was like massive drama once I got there. So here's the one thing I've learned about losing teams, and it's weird. Guys are a lot more accessible to talk to. Like, you become more therapist than journalist when talking to guys, because they're trying to figure, like, there's stages of losing, Ethan, that even Golden State hasn't yet gone through, where you're losing games and you don't know why. If you've been winning for a long time and you're losing games with the same crop of players you've been winning games with, it's a state of disbelief. You're looking around the locker room. You're like, we've won 50 games every year. I'm the same player. This guy's the same player. This guy, what's the problem? And it's like a denial part of it, right? So then as a media member, you're asking them questions. They're a little surly. They're confused, all of this stuff, right? But they don't take it out on you. They're just a little acerbic. And then once it sets in, and they're like, man, we're not as good as we thought. I'm not as good as I thought. Then it becomes a, hey, are we really as bad as we look? And they ask you that question. And they're like, is the problem the players? Is the problem the coach? Is it the front office? And they're literally coming to you as an unbiased, somewhat naive observer, because you don't know every single thing that happens. They're trying to figure out your standpoint from 30,000 feet. Now, the acceptance of losing is the most intriguing one, because at that point, guys say, you know what? We don't give a shit anymore. Mm-hmm. We're here. This is a way station. Can I get out of here? Can I get paid? One, two, three, Cancun. You know what I'm saying? One, two, three. Like, guys, like, I give you a perfect example. It was a Sunday game in the, not the lockout season. It was the 2012-13 season. And the Pistons were in San Antonio on a Sunday afternoon game. I bullshit you not, if you look this up on Basketball Reference, they lost the game by 39 points, okay? It was the end of a road trip. They had gotten murdered in San Antonio. So usually after games like that, it's 60 games into the season. So right after the All-Star break. So me and Vince Ellis from the Detroit Free Press, we walk up to Will Bynum, and who's a reserve point guard, and really like this sort of like Yoda-like figure, because he had a really tough road to get to the league, so he kind of always appreciated where he was. And those are the type of dudes that you always wanted to go to for perspective when they were in situations like this. So you go to ask Will, I'm like, Will, is this the worst loss of the season? And you expect the guy to say, you know, yeah, things will get better. You know, this is pretty bad. This is rock bottom. He looks us straight in the face and says, shit, I don't know. We still got 20 games left. And that's the acceptance of losing, is knowing no matter how bad it is, guess what, guys? It can still get worse.
I mean, that's, yeah, yeah. I think that might be a Yiddish phrase. No matter how bad things are, they could always get worse. And, well, you made an observation to me once, because we would cross paths as these weird carnies known as beat writers back when we were, where you, right. you just see these other strange freak people who go from arena to arena across the country in the dead of winter, and you know how one another's lives are like. And you said something to me that players form better friendships in a losing situation than in a winning situation. And do you still believe that? And why do you believe that?
I believe that if you're in the acceptance stage of losing, right? If you're in the early stages of losing where you're not sure why, then you can start pointing fingers, and that becomes a little bit easier. But when you're in this acceptance stage of losing, it's almost like a situation where I don't know who the problem is. It could be me. It could be you. I know it's not me. It might not be you. It's just the constellation of all of us. And there's nothing that we can do about it. So, you know what? We can bond over this because guess what? We ain't battling over credit. We're not even really battling over blame. Like when winning teams start winning, the best part of it is in the beginning when you're starting to win and it's pure and you don't have to worry about who's getting the credit, who's getting the one-on-one interviews, who's getting, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Who's getting some of the ancillary benefits that come from winning and you realize the benefits of winning. You're just playing.
You know who the least blamed figure is? It's the role player on the losing team because the more prominent player is going to get blamed. Right now we talk about what's wrong with the Wolves. We're probably going to start talking about Towns. We're not going to really go down the list. We're not going to blame their sixth man for it. Versus right. If you're in a winning situation, you're Harrison Barnes, as we mentioned before, and you're missing those three-point shots in the finals, we're coming down on your head. So it's hard to stay in the league. That's the problem. You're competing to stay in the league if you aren't a star in a losing situation often, but you're not really getting hit with a lot of blame because in the NBA, what follows the initial losing is the apathy and the obscurity. It's people just walking away, you know? Nobody's so angry right now about whoever lost the game for the Warriors, but there are tumbleweeds blowing through the locker room after these games.
Well, I think for the Warriors, there's like this general sort of acceptance that this is an interlude.
Well, right? It's only killing one guy.
It could be an extended. It could be an extended interlude, right?
Yeah.
But they don't know that yet.
Yeah.
Like this thing could not turn around. You know, Steph could not be the player that he was. The Splash Brothers may not have the magic that they once had. Like, a lot can change in 2 years in terms of how the league adjusts to you and how, you know, your effectiveness sort of lifts you or sort of keeps you afloat. But you don't know that yet. You know what I'm saying? Like, you're still in this stage of things will get better. But when you're hitting the stage where you know that things won't get better and there's no anchor involved and it's just like, well, you know what, y'all? We just here. We got 20 games left or whatever it is. Like, it's different for championship teams depending on like the tone of your leader. Like, I don't even see Draymond Green pitching a fit if that ever does happen to Golden State.
He's the most emotionally impacted by this. I think he's having the least good time because everybody else who's playing, for the most part, they're young. They're trying to make a name for themselves. They're just trying to get more minutes next game. They're just trying to not get sent down to Santa Cruz. So the fact that the team overall is losing, I don't think that's so much a concern. But for him, I mean, this is like going from eating filet mignon to fill in the blank. It's quite the downgrade. And I think he's almost been left to just soldier on alone while the other principal parts of the team have been out with injury. So I think it's hard on him. And I think he's going through the phases. But yeah, I don't think that there's that dispiriting sense, considering that a lot of these guys, I mean, they're kind of just lucky to be there.
Yeah, I think, and going back to your point, like being in Detroit for a number of years, and there was Andre Drummond, right, who by all accounts had outperformed what people thought he was supposed to be as a ninth pick in a weak draft, right? Like, he completely outperformed the projections, the expectations, everything else. Had it been different, he'd have been pick number two behind Anthony Davis. But because his career was so defined by what wasn't around him as opposed to his own play, so much of that falls on his shoulders, right? Like, if nothing else for Draymond, he'll never be in that position as a – think about it. How many Hall of Famers – and he's going to make the Hall of Fame. How many Hall of Famers – will there be that when stuff got bad, they didn't catch any wreck? Like, things are in Draymond's in such a sweet spot that whether it's because of his limitations or because of the hell he's already caught, that if Golden State doesn't come back and be what they were, you're going to go down a long list before you point at Draymond Green.
Yeah.
And even though the losing affects him, there's still like a level of criticism that he's going to be forever shielded from, unless he's just an obvious weak link and Steph and Clay are back to everything that they were times two and he's literally like dragging the caboose on the back end, which I don't see happening. I see it either them returning to some level of prominence, if not just relevance, or not working at all. And either way, I don't think you can look at Draymond Green, a Hall of Famer, I keep telling people, and saying, you know what, this is on you.
You like the Wiggins thing for them? I was reading what you wrote about it. We were both in New York when it happened. What do you think? What do you think overall about it?
That's an interesting thing. Like, the thing that intrigued me was the draft pick.
Yeah.
Perfect, to be perfectly honest. And the fact that it's top three protected. So basically, you're just saying, as long as the Timberwolves do not fall on their face in epic fashion next year, then we're going to get their first round pick, which could be number four, number eight, cost controlled, right? In a luxury tax world, on a luxury tax team, is that more valuable than the actual player? Is Andrew Wiggins, to me, like, I'm not saying he's a sunk cost, but I'm certainly saying, look, he's a productive player. He's a talented player, but he hasn't shown to be a winning player. He hasn't shown to be an impactful player. He has all the gifts, but how many guys have we seen that have all the gifts and never put it together in a winning situation, no matter what environment you have? And the problem with winning teams, it can be the Miami Heat when they were in their heyday. It could be the San Antonio Spurs. It could be whatever franchise, you know, Cleveland Cavaliers, LeBron system, whatever you say. Whenever teams have a certain level of success, especially when they pick up a couple of spare parts that wound up overplaying what everybody thought they were going to be, they wind up getting this sort of organizational arrogance that says, I can turn around any player.
Yeah.
We can make this guy who hasn't worked with, we can make him something. We can sprinkle our magic, you know, Stephen Curry juice on him, and you two shall be healed by the magic of Golden State. And I don't think that that's actually, like, true. It happens in some cases, but by and large, they don't. And I think it's a swing. It's a big swing, clearly, because you could have held on to D'Angelo Russell and got something better for him. In my opinion, with this draft pick that you're going to have this summer, you could have held on to him for the rest of the season, saw what was going to work, and then fetched that for a better player than Andrew Wiggins, a more proven basketball player, not more talented, but a better basketball player than Andrew Wiggins. And I wonder if they've bit off more of their, they're looking at them championship trophies on the wall and they got a little seduced by that.
I think it's a possibility. At the same time, I've been a little intrigued by the early returns, and there's a little bit of buzz on how they are passing the ball more, and he's going to be operating more as a role player. It's something to watch. Usually the people who express pessimism in these instances are proven correct, usually. I mean, I think Nate Duncan has made a career off being very clear-eyed in his assessment, not getting caught up, and to the point of killing Sabonis. Killing, did you see that where Nate became the enemy of Indiana? Did you see that?
No, what did he say?
I think the tweet was something like Sabonis is the worst all-star selection in some time. And
wow, that's a lot.
I mean, I'm not prepared to disagree. I would have to really think about it. And I think he talked about it on his show and he explained where he was coming from. But man, people out there, the local media in Indiana, I mean, I guess this means Nate's big time because it became a legitimate story out there that he said that.
Well, I mean, A, it's Indiana. There's not a whole lot that there's levels of I shouldn't be saying this. There's levels of racism in the NBA.
I thought you were going in the boredom direction. I thought you were going there.
Well, that too, right? But I was talking the other day, I think it was, I was with Howard Beck, the esteemed Howard Beck, and we were sitting in the Brooklyn Arena and they had, and this is a crazy aside that you'll just find delicious, right? There was, for Black History Month, the Barclays Center, the Brooklyn Nets, they had like a choir singing Lift Every Voice and Sing before they sung the national anthem, okay? So it's, think about, you know, pregame, all of that, all the pleasantries and all that stuff, right?
Yeah.
They're singing Lift Every Voice and Sing, which is commonly referred to as the Black National Anthem. Nobody knows the song because at the end of the song, usually there's like applause, right? You know, you sing the national anthem, you perform or whatever, polite applause, yeah. Right? But it usually happens right after Home of the Brave. And as soon as you finish with Brave, there's applause.
Yeah.
After this one, it was like a 5-second pause. They were like, is this the end of the song? Is it the end of the song? We don't know the words. Is this just a long pause? Black people like to string things out a little bit. This might not be the end of the song. And then they started clapping. And then the black people sang the national anthem, for which they clapped on cue, right? Yeah. And Howard Beck came up and said, like, would this happen in Atlanta? Where would this happen at? And we came up with the blackest and the whitest of NBA cities. And Indiana is one of those in the category of the quote unquote whitest of NBA cities. So although they would be kind to Nate Duncan, they ain't kind to everybody.
Or if you're going with a racial anthropological theory bank shot, you would say they'd be more protective of Sabonis. Which, I mean, that would be another potential theory. Although, I don't know if I believe that theory. I was arguing with Marcus, and I don't know if we're getting ourselves in trouble. Jade is off this call, so, you know, whatever. Marcus and I were arguing about it. Marcus believes that the white American sports fan prefers a white European player to a black player. And I said, I mean, it's in this zone where I just don't think they care. I just don't think that white American sports fans care about European players like that and versus it's like love or hate when it comes to it's like, well, I love LeBron, he's on the Cavs, he's on my Cavs, oh, he goes to Miami, I hate LeBron. If LeBron was you know, a Luka, then he would leave and there wouldn't be, it's like it wouldn't inspire the same love and it wouldn't inspire the same hate. That's my theory.
It's the extremes don't fall in between, like, yeah. Higher floor, lower ceiling.
Yes,
in terms of the reaction.
That's exactly what I'm going for.
But make no mistake.
This is all we do, by the way, NBA game.
Everything. Yeah. Race is a factor in everything, especially in the NBA. Like, you know what my random thought was?
What?
I was curious if NBA ratings had an effect because even not because they were black players in the Eastern, strictly in the Eastern Conference, I'm talking about Ben Simmons, Joel Embiid, and Giannis. Mm-hmm. And their black faces, you know, their melanated faces. And even in the case of Ben Simmons, who's light skinned, you know, you still look at him and you say black man, right? But you don't look at him and say American black man. And I wonder if there's a difference in how the American fan looks at a guy named Joel Embiid and Giannis Antetokounmpo compared to Zion Williamson. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. I think
even though there's black faces, American black faces are a little bit different than just black faces.
Well, I think that simplicity helps you brand, and any sort of thing that people aren't used to that requires an explanation is another layer to get through. Mm-hmm. When I was over at my wife's family's house around Christmas time, and the I think it was Sixers Bucks, and I was just, because they didn't know who these stars were, which tells me that, right, the NBA might be in a bad way, by the way, that, you know, this entire all the men there who are sports fans, they're not NBA fans per se, but they don't dislike the NBA. And they've never heard of Giannis. And so I'm saying, yeah, they call him the Greek freak, and there's this, he's Greek? Like, it's just confusion. It's just like, it's just confusion. There's another layer there. But I do think, and this is a general theory of mine, that nationalism, patriotism, whatever you want to call it, and I'm not somebody who feels a lot of it myself, to be clear. I'm pretty bored during the anthem and whatnot, but I recognize what appeals to a lot of people. I think it's often underrated by people who are pretty wealthy and who fly around the world a lot, people who might say, I don't know, work at the top of the league office, and they don't recognize that and they don't realize that. And that is an impact on why they're struggling domestically as of late. That is a theory of mine. I'm not saying that you don't allow the international players who are great to come to the NBA. No, they earn that spot. But, you know, John Hollinger was pointing out today on Twitter that the construction of the Rising Stars game, where it's international versus the U.S., I mean, I think Hollinger tweeted, bigger issue is format works against American players because there are more of them and fewer internationals to choose from. Several good U.S. guards shafted. It just seems to me that the NBA is often promoting how international it is. We're so international. Look at our bona fides. Look at us. Look at we're growing. We're growing in China up until recently, but we're growing. We're growing internationally. They never really, it seems to me, put the flag on their chest. Not nearly like the NFL. And I'm not saying that they should have flyovers, not just because it's impossible and seems very dangerous to do that within an arena, but I'm not saying that they do all that, but they don't really try to represent America, even though this is the cradle of basketball, even though they very well could. And to me, that seems like a mistake, and it seems like something that's hurting them domestically.
Well, I think here's the thing, and I completely agree with you. The NBA felt like, in my opinion, they felt like there was a ceiling on their popularity domestically. Like you were not going to catch the NFL in terms of becoming America's new pastime. Like once we realized that baseball was not it and football became it, there wasn't as much oxygen, you know, especially when you consider all the traditional media means, you know, back when the NBA started to make their international push. So they had to do it from a revenue standpoint and a popularity standpoint. Hey, let's be inclusive. Let's bring all these other, you know, guys in. Let's make the game look a little bit different, i.e. a little more white. Like it was almost simplistic. Like white fans will take any white guy as long as he's not black. Like you can say that that's what the league was thinking, because maybe they were believing that fans wouldn't have the sophistication enough to care that this guy came from Lithuania or this guy came from Greece or this guy came from.
I guess there was no way to know.
And when the league is quote unquote too black, like you got to find some level of elixir, especially when your faces are like the faces of your league. Are black. It's not that the NFL isn't black. They're 75% black, but the faces of the NFL are white. The faces of the NBA are black, and you can't run from that. Well, and you're trying to figure out a way to appeal to a white populace. And so they basically said, and Ethan, this is my feeling on the greatness of David Stern, right? David Stern told white people, you're not as racist as you think. You can deal with Magic, and you can deal with Julius, and you can deal with Michael, and you can deal with Isaiah, and you could deal with these black faces being around you. Yes, we get Larry Bird too, but you're not as racist as you think you are when you place these labels on this black league. You can deal, and you will deal. The problem on the back end of that was, okay, maybe they are as maybe I miscalculated this on some level. Maybe they've gotten too used to these black faces and it's too radical for them. It's moving too fast for them. So maybe we got to sprinkle in, you know, the white guys in the name of, you know, inclusion, diversity, whatever you want to call it, and make our game better, which to some degree it did. Like you see more of an international effect on the game than you ever would domestically.
Well, so, okay, so this is an interesting question. Do you think that the NBA, so you view it as the NBA was looking to diversify the people within it as a measure of domestic popularity. I just always looked at it as they were chasing the money that could be had abroad.
Absolutely.
And they kind of got a little bit, I don't know whether to call it unlucky or whatnot. I mean, Waz and I were talking about this. There's this vision that the NBA had for itself of what was going to happen, because it's, oh my God, look at these stars emerging in some of these countries, and they're massive countries. I mean, geez, we've got Yao Ming. We're going to have another Yao Ming. We're just going to have a bunch of Chinese superstars. It's going to be massive. And, you know, some of the European guys, I mean, they come from some pretty big countries. I mean, Germany is a huge country, and we've got Dirk and, oh man, in Spain. Spain's a fairly prominent European country, and, you know, France and whatnot. And then it seems in the end, though, that the talent pool out there internationally, it's just tiny Eastern European countries. It's just that's where they're getting, you know, that's where they're getting guys like Luka. Luka's from a country that has fewer people than a small U.S. state in the end. And I look, you can't do anything about it. Whoever comes up is whoever comes up. But it is funny to me that they really thought it would be something different than what it turned out to be, in my opinion.
Well, not so much that they were sure of what it would turn out to be, but they were open to the possibilities of what it could be on the you know, on the front end of it, right? Like they were looking at it like there's no blowback, there's no negative, you know, possibilities on if we don't find these diverse looking, you know, superstars. And on some level, you're right, but you know, in this way that we wrap our arms around the flag and we're so patriotic and everything else, like there is a back end to that where you have to at least acknowledge the fact that fans connect with players that they know, not even necessarily like white. Let's just say Zion, for example. If Zion were a white superstar, not even athletically, not even all this other type of stuff, but Zion had a path that we followed. We followed him from his high school mixtapes to Duke, which is the blue blood of all blue bloods, right? Everybody can identify with being Duke. Either you are a Dukie or you want to be a Dukie on some level, right? So then once he gets to the NBA, he's a known commodity. You understand it. You see it. So now it's like, okay, we can wrap our arms around, even though he's quote unquote black and all this other type of stuff, or, you know, even if you don't think that they will embrace black players. But they do embrace black players. They embrace something that they know. They embrace something that's tangible, that's reachable, that's attainable. Mm-hmm. And that's what he looks like because they can see it, the straight line. You can't see the straight line with the foreign guys.
Yeah, you weren't there. Face. You weren't there at the beginning. You don't have the context right for where they were. And then there's the language barrier. I mean, I think a lot of white fight fans love Conor McGregor, even though he's from another country. But you know, he speaks that other country speaks English. And so that's a massive aspect of it. And Waz and I were mulling the possibility of how much more popular Luka would be if his name was Luke Donald and he was from whatever U.S. state you want to name. And I think it's a magnitude of 10, at least it would be different as opposed to.
They have to understand it. It has to make sense for them. Like, we are very simplistic people.
Which is why Adam Silver and them shouldn't have changed the All-Star game and added all these rules. It's too much for people.
It's too much for me. Like, I'm not trying to add up all these numbers at the end of three quarters, add 24 to it and everything else. Like, dude, look, my thing is, if it ain't broke, don't break it. And the All-Star game's problem isn't, you know, a lack of one thing or another. It's simply the fact that every regular season looks like an All-Star game. and if you speed it up and you lower the stakes and you say, guys, you know, we're not going to get hurt and everything else. These players are so big, fast, and strong that, you know, part of the greatness of the games before was the athletic limitations of the superstars of the 80s and 90s. You didn't have guys that could do things the way that these guys can do things. It's become largely too easy.
Yeah. Well, I think you just add cash prize. Or maybe not even a cash prize. Maybe buy something. Something's rustling around. Do you hear that? What are you doing, Vinny? What are you doing? Are you rubbing sandpaper against the mic? What's going on? I'm playing the role of Jade.
I wasn't rubbing sandpaper around anywhere, Ethan. I apologize.
are you rubbing triple down goose on the microphone? What are you doing?
I was packing a Hugo Boss suit. I'm sorry.
A Hugo Boss suit. Ah, the preparations you have to make. Pivoting to a team with a lot of players who are from America. I mean, how are international are the Rockets? I'm trying to remember. I just want to go back down the memory lane of I want to go back down the memory lane because people never go back after these things unfold. You know, you're in the storm of it. You're in the eye of it. But you had a report on the Houston Rockets.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that there was a pushback on your report. You were a crazy man saying crazy things, stirring the pot and whatnot.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Insane. I was crazy. I was coming up with stuff in my own head.
And you ended up being validated in the end. Only nobody ever really comes back and throws you a parade for having been right in that time.
Never. Never. You never get the flowers that you deserve, right?
Could you potentially walk us through that journey, but only if you pause packing that suit that's making noise?
I'm sorry. What I will say is you're hearing things after the season is over. You know that there's drama between, you know, Chris Paul and James Harden. And you're just talking to sources. Ethan, you know how this goes. You're talking to people. And someone I'm on the phone with says, you know, they got real problems over there. I'm like, what do you mean real problems? And he starts going through it. And I'm like, wait a minute, I haven't seen that anywhere. I thought it was in, you know, the whole ESPN report that came out from Tim McMahon or whatever. And there was nothing in there about that. And I was like, okay, was that just, you know, left out, whatever the case may be, right? And you start making a few more calls. You double back and make more calls. And you're like, okay, there's actually smoke to this fire. You hear one side, you hear another side. You know, then the report comes out. And it comes out in a way that makes it look like Chris Paul just can't stand James Harden, when it looked like neither guy could really take being around the other for very valid reasons. You know, on either side, if you're James Harden, you're used to kicking it a certain way, then you're not like Chris Paul.
People are often right about each other. I mean, when they fall apart, when teams fall apart, they've got valid points about one another.
Absolutely. So I never looked at it as – I looked at it as two coworkers, two very talented coworkers who couldn't get along, and nobody was really at fault as much as it was. You just can't work together anymore. And sometimes these things have a shelf life, and I felt like they had a shelf life, and that's what it, you know, that's what I didn't look at it from a standpoint of, you know, these guys are terrible or one person's to blame. I looked at it as, Ethan, they had a very small window to accomplish what they wanted to accomplish, and they worked together despite how they felt about each other. And then when it didn't work, okay, boom, just letting it go now. You know what I'm saying? Like just letting it go, and neither side wants to be around each other anymore.
Well, I don't care about them. I mean, like both Chris Paul and James Harden, they wanted to be on the podcast, but I said no. I had you on the podcast. How did it feel for you going through that, where I assume in Houston you became, you know, what Nate Duncan became in Indiana in a different way? What was that like? What was your take on that?
I was surprised a little bit at the reaction. I didn't know the Houston Rockets had a hive. I discovered that there was a Rockets hive when fans were telling me, don't show up to Houston. You know what I'm saying? Or anything like that. And I'm like, whoa, like this ain't that serious. Like I've written more, you know, serious things about teams not liking each other or whatever. And I could show up in the locker room the next day, and if guys had words for me, guys had words, but never from like the fan base, you know? So it was kind of different. And, you know, a couple of reporters went out of their way to try to discredit me. And that was one of those things that I had to bite my tongue about. You know what I'm saying?
Can we be honest? Because he's a friend of mine. And I'm using this, by the way, I'm using this bait right here. This is bait because I'm frustrated about something else. I'm frustrated with how I've got a lot of friends at ESPN. Some people who are among my best friends are at ESPN, and the company won't allow them to come on to this podcast. And yet, and I, you know, you're over at Yahoo, I'm at The Athletic, and it seems like, you know, we understand as companies that our company's fortunes aren't going to rise and fall based off us getting a podcast guest from somewhere else. But that seems to be the way that it's done at ESPN for whatever reason. And I'm just going to use this as bait. Tim McMahon, you're my friend. You're a good reporter, but you were wrong for how you handled Vinny's report. And Vinny was validated. Boom. There you have it.
You said it, not me. So I'll let that one. And, you know, I'm the king of petty. I can be petty on Twitter and all these other different social platforms, and I will be well within like my range. Like me being petty is not something that is foreign to me. On that one, I had to, you know, you got to resist the urge. You got to be professional and everything else. And then once the trade happens, if you remember, I put up merely a Tupac GIF of him shrugging his shoulders and one of his music videos. And I was like, there's nothing for me to say. I literally, you know, whether the trade happened or not, wasn't going to validate me. I knew that what I wrote was solid. It took everybody else for that trade to happen, for them to believe what I was writing. And Tim's got a, you know, Tim is a quality, solid human being from what I know.
First of all, that's not true. He's my friend, but that part's not true. But yes,
I have not run into Tim McMahon since that report.
Oh, that's all I'll say. Well, I think you might run into him this All-Star break and the triple fat goose feathers will fly, my friend. We're going to wrap. We are going to wrap right there. Vinny, it's been too long since we decided to do this. Come back. We need to have you back on the podcast. You can read his work at Yahoo. You can read my work at The Athletic. Buy The Victory Machine, everybody. It's coming out April 14th, but you can pre-order today. As mentioned before, I am doing the audiobook. I am putting everything I can into it. I am pronouncing certain names correctly. Until next time, everybody, have a great All-Star break. I almost stuck the landing. It didn't happen. Have a great All-Star break.
See ya. Glamour that shit up and put a bow on it.
Nothing to do with you. This game will be here. This game was here before you. It's gonna be here way out of you. So nobody cares about you.